Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We'll be here for the next hour talking about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Looks like it's going to be another nice day today. We do have a special guest with us today. Brad Lefkowitz from Waves Landscape Design is in the office. I can't really say studio.
It's a studio.
With us. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Oh, we're happy to have you. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what it is that Waves Landscape Design does?
So I do primarily residential landscape design. I'll work with a client, really tailor a design to what they're looking to do at their house. And that can include anything as small as a little planting plan update to a full redo of the property with hardscape walls, fencing, water capture, anything you can imagine. I've pretty much designed it.
Now, water capture, water capture and then gray water use, two different things, but you can provide services for both of those, correct?
Yeah, so that's one thing I'm really passionate about and have a lot of experience with. Rainwater capture, when you're talking about cisterns or putting water into the ground with swales and different kind of topography, or gray water usually is going to be you're using your laundry water and the pump on your washing machine to pump that water out into the garden.
As far as regulations are concerned, we were talking about it before the show. You said it's kind of in San Diego County, it's kind of a mixed bag, and it really varies depending on where you are, city by city, or then you have the unincorporated areas of the county. It's all over the map.
Yeah, all over the map. Different cities, different parts of the county. You're going to get a lot of different regulations and input from your inspectors depending on the level of project you're doing. For the most part, if you're putting rainwater into a cistern, there's nothing really you have to worry about. But on a lot of new builds, particularly where I live in Sanitas, they're mandating stormwater management and making you dig big BMPs is what they call it. I'm not quite sure why they call it that, but it's a bioinfiltration basin where they'll, you know, a lot of people are adding ADUs. So per square foot of impermeable surface you add, usually in like a roof on an ADU, they'll do a calculation for how many square feet of a basin you need to add. So some cities are really strict about enforcing it on new builds. Some cities are, you know, kind of let you do what you want. Some cities are enforcing gray water as well now. So it's still very much the Wild West, I guess a bit in terms of what people are expected to do and able to do. But there's lots of lower level, easy things to do for someone that's just looking to add something to their existing garden.
Well, I know one of the things that's become pretty popular in recent years, as far as stormwater runoff is concerned and mitigating that, is the bioswale.
Yeah.
The concept of a bioswale, which is basically a swale that's layered with soil, sometimes plants, just an area for the water to go to where it will soak back into the ground rather than go into the storm drain and run off.
Yeah, that's something I really get excited about. It's a lot of fun. I think we all know dry creek beds. They've been around for a long time. A lot of people weren't necessarily doing that for the sole purpose of sinking water into their property. It's a cool decorative feature. And I've tried to really make sure that if you're going to go the length of installing a feature like that, that it really serves the purpose of slowing and sinking water into the soil. And that can look a lot of different ways. You can use a lot of rocks. It can be a big square pit. I have a sunken lawn in my front yard that's really fun, filled with Carex pragracilis, that's performing really well. Again, the dry creek beds are a common feature. You just need to make sure you have some flat sections in there so the water has an opportunity to slow and sink down into the ground. You can plant them up with juncus, different carex species, or you can have it just be a cool rock feature. There's lots of different ways to do it, and it's a lot of fun to design some topography into the landscape rather than just have a flat yard.
Very interesting. Typically, how much rainwater will an average household catch with, or is it basically unlimited as far as the storage is concerned?
Right. So it's never really a question of how much you can generate. It's a question of how much space you're willing to devote to storing it or sinking it into the ground. Mm-hmm. I can say anyone listening to this radio show within the county, in an average year, you're going to generate more than 10,000 gallons of runoff.
Wow.
So the calculation is for every 1,000 square feet of roof in 1 inch of rain, you're going to generate 600 gallons of water. So we average 10 inches of rain. You know, that's going to be different from the coastal to the inland, mm-hmm. the different microclimates here. But anytime I've actually gone the length of doing the math for a property, it's going to be far, far more than you have the potential to even store, you know. So it's a question of how big of a cistern are you willing to put in? How deep of a swale are you willing to dig? How much square footage are you willing to give up in your property to do that? And that's again really different throughout the county from some of these, you know, more inland areas where you have an acre or 2 acres of space to some of the more densely developed places near the coast where, you know, you have your five foot side yards and your smaller backyards where significant capture is really a challenge. So it's again, it's thousands and thousands and thousands of gallons that your average home can generate. So it's really, that's where the fun comes in terms of tailoring a solution to an individual property based on what people are looking to do with it.
That's very interesting. I know when I was a kid, my grandmother had a big ceramic crock that I'm sure she brought out from the farm in Nebraska, but it had a big plate on top of it that was a big dish on top of it. And in the center of the dish, there was a very small hole about the size of a pencil. And she would leave that out in the backyard. And whenever it would rain, it would fill up with rainwater. So she almost always had a few gallons of rainwater at the house at any given time. Very, very small scale. But, you know, she growing up on a farm in Nebraska in the early 1900s, they didn't throw anything away. They made sure that they used everything that they possibly could.
What I've found challenging is I have a home in Rancho Penasquitos that's a rental now, but when I lived there, I had a bunch of rain tanks, larger, you know, 205 and 165. Anyway, I would store about 1,100 gallons with a good rain. The challenge was I didn't need that water till August, and then I used it once, and I was done watering all the fruit trees, and then I was done till the following year. So to your point, you know, how much area are you willing to devote to a larger storage? And in your website, you had mentioned that, you know, you're really passionate, your company is very passionate about that and going beyond the capacity of that 50-gallon rain barrel that a lot of people put next to their one downspout.
Yeah, so I'm as passionate as I am about rainwater capture, I'm actually pretty fervently against the 50-gallon rain barrel because it fills up so quickly. And again, it fills up when you don't need it. And when you do need it in the dry months, you go through it really quickly. Particularly because there's a 200, I think it's 200 or 240 gallon cistern from Bushman that has pretty much the same footprint as a 50 gallon rain barrel.
I have one of those actually.
Yeah. So yes. I think that should be a minimum starting point for most people. But yeah, the challenge is we have a short rainy season and a long dry season. So to store enough to get you through the dry season is ambitious, you know, and if you're growing fruit trees, that's one thing. If you have a really native forward and Mediterranean landscape, that's another. Water is going to go to different places. So, you know, you do it because it's the right thing to do because there's certain plants that really like that rainwater as opposed to the salty water we get from the city. And there's different ways to do it, but you're generally not doing it for return on investment. You're doing it because a little bit of security in case of, you know, it's nice to have a few hundred gallons of water in case of an earthquake or a fire or something that might shut off your services. And it's a nice thing to have to know you're doing something to keep that precious little bit of rainwater we do get to put it into the ground rather than send it off to the storm drain.
Oh, even if you're an avid houseplant collector, just using it on your houseplants is going to be a night and day difference between the tap water that we have. The untreated tap water that we have in San Diego is very alkaline.
And I think the city would argue with you. Our tap water is treated.
Well, post-treatment tap water. Yeah. But yeah, it'll make a significant difference in your houseplants if you can water with rainwater rather than tap water.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something.
I was, and I forgot what I was going to say.
I know that, Jen, you've talked about a lot. You know, we're at the end of the Colorado. Our water is very salty, and a lot of our plants don't respond well to it. You know, our avocados don't do well, and Kenyon, a lot of the houseplants. So I have a Japanese maple on our porch that, and when we use rainwater or some good filtered water, it thrives. If we use regular, you know, tap water, it starts to get the burned tips, just like the avocados do. So the rainwater, if there's a way to capture enough to be able to use when you need it, even on those few plants, you can make a huge difference on the way those plants will look.
It definitely helps. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a lot of clients that have that one avocado tree. So they have maybe a 200-gallon cistern they use a few times throughout the summer to help flush out some of those salts from the avocado tree.
Yeah, that will definitely help too. If you can't use it all the time, just flushing it out periodically, getting the salt, washing the salts out of the soil or down deeper into the soil out of the root zone certainly does help. And, you know, if you want to know how the benefits of rainwater, just look at how the landscape in San Diego changes after a big rainstorm. Everything turns green and stuff starts growing all over the place. So it really is beneficial.
I think water catchment aside and using gray water aside, San Diego Gardener Group on Facebook, we have almost 22,000 people. And I'm always stunned the number of people who just post a picture of their front yard and say, okay, group, design for me a beautiful garden. What plants should I put? And I go, you cheapskate. Just go get a good designer. You don't need a landscape architect, but I am huge proponent of good qualified landscape designers. The APLD, they have a great list. Nan Sturman, Brad is another one. Andrea Dunan, Amelia Lima. I mean, so many of my friends that are tremendous landscape designers. You don't need to spend the big bucks for the architect, but have them come out and at least give you some brainstorming ideas on what to do with your property, because it will just completely radically change what you end up with versus you trying to piecemeal it and, you know, talk to your neighbors and friends. Yeah,
absolutely. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements and our special guest, Brad Lefkowitz from Waves Landscape Design. As we were going into the break, we were talking about landscape design. And when we had our design office open prior to the markets falling apart in 2008, one of the things that we used to sell the design service was if you contract with a landscape designer to come up with the plan for your yard, or if you need even more serious work or a landscape architect, when you make the deal to have that design done, that's your design. Then when that design is finished and you go start talking to installers, they're all bidding off of the same set of plans. So you can really compare apples to apples to what you're going to get from that contractor or that installer. If you go with a design build company, they will design something and they will bid that project, but that's basically their project and you can't really shop that design amongst other contractors. So it makes it very difficult to compare apples to apples when you do it that way. But if you have your own designer, it can make a big difference when it comes to shopping around. So you do design work, but you don't do installation, correct?
Correct. I'm a one-man show. I have my little design studio in my backyard, and I really try to, as you were saying, you know, I try to meet the clients where they're at and tailor a solution specifically to their needs. And once that design is done, there's a lot of great builders in town, and I'll help them connect them with a builder I think is a good fit. But as you said, they do own that design, so they're able to solicit their own bids and compare apples to apples, go through those line items, try to answer as many questions on that design as possible that the builder is going to need to figure out and put numbers to for the client.
Hey, Brad, we mentioned in the earlier segment, you know, a landscape design versus architect. What is that? What does an architect do that a designer won't do?
I mean, an architect is needed if you're doing some significant building projects, usually, whether it's maybe a big deck over a slope or really big retaining walls that might be permitted, you know, over 36 inches. Real heavy-duty construction projects are where an architect is going to need to come in. There's design-build firms, and there's contractors that can do that under their permits as well. But for designers, we usually operate in the world of conceptual plans, where we're kind of helping the client map out their property in 2D, and then depending on what their building will bring in, builders, contractors that are permitted to do certain things, or sometimes architects will come in for a portion of the project as well. But designers are usually working on, you know, walls that are under 36 inches, standard fencing and planting plans and irrigation and more low impact stuff.
Yeah, usually, and also if you have significant soil engineering, big grade changing, you know, then you're going to want a landscape architect. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. They're two very similar but different disciplines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Designers are usually known for being a little more plant people, mm-hmm. Where architects are usually more on the construction details.
The hardscape side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Do you have any particular landscape themes that you favor over?
Yeah, I mean,
anything else?
I've done it all. If left to my own devices, like in my house, my theme is clean lines, crazy plants. So personally, mm-hmm. I like my built elements, my decks, my concrete, my walls to be straight lines. And then you use boulders and plants to kind of soften that up with a little bit of organic chaos. That's my personal preference, but I've done it all for clients. People really have different tastes and different architecture styles that you want to kind of take into account in terms of the house. But yeah, I'm in my heart, I'm a bit of a modern minimalist, but then I get a little crazy with the plants, which is where you have the fun.
Yeah, Brad's house was on the San Diego Horticultural Society APLD tour last year.
Oh.
In Encinitas, and it was one of my favorites on that tour. And so, yeah, very clean lines and very geometric, but then I call them wow plants. So Brad had some real standouts. You know, what I like to see in a garden are things that I'm not going to see in every bank parking lot. So, you know, search for the good stuff. And so his yard was full of some pretty amazing standout accent plants.
Yeah, it's funny you talk about the bank parking lot. In my neighborhood in Scripps Ranch, there was a landscape design build company that was going through when the houses were built. And you could drive through the neighborhood and you could say, he did that house,
yep.
He did that house, he did that house, because it was Phoenix Robellini, Queen Palms, and Agapanthus were
over and over and over again.
Over and over and over. And there's most of the houses at this point have evolved away from that original landscape, but you can still spot them when you drive through the neighborhood.
A lot of people put those in because mm-hmm. many of those are incredibly bulletproof.
They are.
So if you're looking for something that, you know, I don't want to do a lot of work in the yard. I want stuff that I know is going to survive. You can look out and say, that's been there forever. That's been there forever. Mm-hmm. And that'll work.
And the client's not going to call you in 3 months saying, hey, this died.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. True. Yeah. In fact, in Scripps Ranch in the 80s, I used to just park my truck and we would landscape house after house after house, and then we'd maintain them. I would literally have one crew go and they'd sit on a block and they'd work all day doing five houses in a row or something.
And they were the same plants on each house?
No, not in my designs. No, heck no. But John DeMaria, who's a fabulous landscape contractor, he and I were working in that area in the 80s. And then there was one significant place over on, I think it was on Similon. Just the most beautiful hardscape I've ever seen. And then we're doing an Andrea Dunan design job in Rancho Santa Fe. And I went, my gosh, this looks like John DeMaria's work. And it was. Yeah. And so we reconnected after 40 years or so. But yeah, the right guys to do. So, you know, and to me, get the guys who specialize. John's not doing design work. He's doing installation of very talented designers' work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's good sometimes to fragment those things. Get the best designer you can, and then the best hardscape guy, and then the best plant and irrigation group sometimes. So sometimes it gets broken down into different disciplines, but you can't go wrong with a good designer.
That is true. And I like the fact that you don't concentrate on one specific genre, so to speak, of landscaping, where you look for you look for some of the more unusual stuff. I'm kind of a plant geek myself, and it doesn't matter if it's a native or if it's a tropical or it's cactus or succulent. If it's a neat plant, it's a neat plant. It doesn't matter where it comes from. And I like the fact that you're willing to incorporate that into your design work.
Yeah, there's some plants I use on most jobs, but there's always room for something fun. And clients have really, really different tastes. You know, some people have strong feelings about certain colors or certain shapes, or they love cactus or they hate cactus, or they had one native plant at a house, you know, 10 years ago that didn't do well, so they're swearing off natives forever. And so, you know, there's always a dance and some education that you want to do, and sometimes you'll sneak in something and just not tell them it's a native, maybe. or sometimes, you know, you'll open their hearts, you'll take them on see a couple properties. You know, one nice thing about my house, I have 170 different plants. So I say, come over, just tell me 10 plants you like. And then that's a good starting point. And I can show them a lot of different stuff and then have some experience to share with them too.
And we've talked about it before too. And when you go to independent nurseries like us, mm-hmm. or Mission Hills, Barrels and Branches.
Yeah, Sam is great. Yeah.
You'll find stuff that's not we would refer to it as top 40 plants. Mm-hmm. And that's what you find in Home Depot and Lowe's, mm-hmm. and right, things like right. that. The stuff that can, the commodities that can be mass produced and easily moved. But you'll find the unusual stuff that can really highlight your landscape and personalize it to the point where you're not going to find it in anybody else's yard. And in my backyard, I have a huge variegated Ficus bengalensis on one side.
Oh, my goodness.
And on the opposite side over by the pool, Melanie hates it, but I have a giant Ficus rox spurgei.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
That's a botanic garden plant.
It's, yeah. both of them are just spectacular plants, but I wouldn't have, if I didn't know what I was looking for, I never would have found them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, when you get out to the independents, you'll mm-hmm. find some. Yep. Some interesting stuff.
I was at the big box store that's predominantly orange yesterday, and they had so many plants that aren't suitable to our area. There was one whole end cap of peonies, and they weren't Edo peonies. They were peonies you'd grow in Illinois and Indiana and places like that. And so people really go and buy things that aren't going to work.
Yeah.
And so having people that are knowledgeable to advise you on plant choices, plant placement, no, it's so important.
I have to go back though. Why does your wife not like? You just said they're spectacular plants, but you also said your wife hates it.
It molts. It drops.
They drop a lot.
It drops foliage. Just for certain periods of time, and then they'll really. It's already got new foliage coming on it, but it drops a lot of foliage, and the foliage is huge. Right. So
covers. Roxbury guys, a couple feet across.
Covers a big area when it starts
and those
falling.
Big hard figs too.
Oh yeah, it's covered with. I need to go out and cut the figs off of it because the amount of figs it produces is crazy. It's unfortunate that they're not edible, but you'll find interesting things like that when you get out and start looking around. If we hadn't have gotten those, I never would have had them. So and we're always on the lookout for interesting, unusual specimen type plants like that. One of the ones that we have right now that I think we had one out for sale, but I don't know if we sold it or not. Damaropsis. Mm. I hadn't seen Damaropsis kingiana in decades.
What is the common name for that one?
Damaropsis.
Okay.
Common name. We don't call it common.
Beautiful. Names. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Absolutely beautiful plant. It's in the ficus family. Yeah. Huge foliage. Yep.
Like a platter.
Yeah. I knew what it was, but I don't remember any common name. And usually my wife will hit me up later after we listen to the show Saturday morning and say, what was the common name for that? You didn't mention it. So I always
ficus
try to
Damaropsis.
Ask.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes they call it dinner plate fig one of the common names.
So when we spot things like that, we will buy them. And, we have landscapers and designers that come in looking for those kinds of specimen plants that's going to really set something apart.
Absolutely. Pretty much every job, my last trip is to either here or your location in Point Loma to get a nice specimen or two to sneak into a job. It's always nice.
Yeah. yeah, there's some neat stuff.
So out what's
there.
The most unusual plant you think you've ever put in a client's yard?
John, we're going to have to come back to that.
All right, I have some time to think.
Yeah.
There you go.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to be back with more Garden Talk right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements and our special guest, Brad Lefkowitz from Waves Landscape Design. Brad has a class if you'd like to. You just rattled off the title of the class, so I'll let you do that again because I didn't make a note.
That's right. It's Creative Rainwater Capture in Residential Gardens.
That's going to be on the 17th.
May 17th. Yeah. Brad will be teaching in Poway at 9:30. Yeah. Yes.
And today, the class today, May 3rd, is Staghorn.
Care, Culture, and Remounting.
Yeah. Yeah. And James, our store manager, James Flynn, is going to be teaching that class as well.
Correct.
And they're actually far easier to grow than most people think. So you can come into the class and he will tell you everything you need to know to be successful in growing them. And you'll probably end up with more than you can use.
Typically,
if you do it right. Mm-hmm. So anyway, John, you posed a question just before we went off the air.
Yeah, I think, I'm going to break it up into two questions, I think. So one being, what's the most unusual plant that you've ever put in a client's garden? And then secondly, I can read a lot of times different designers I know I can actually look at a landscape and decide who did it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I have a whole list of what I would call Nan Sturman plants, maybe mm-hmm. Melaleuca diosmifolia, Acacia pendula. I can always see, that's a Nan garden. So what would be the Brad Lefkowitz palette of maybe frequently used plants? And then what's the most unusual plant that you've put in a landscape?
Every design I do is going to have Lamandra. You know, every client wants low water, low maintenance, and it doesn't get any more low maintenance or bulletproof than Lamandra. Lamandra Shorty is my current favorite. Mm. Platinum Beauty, everyone was using for a long time, but they're getting a lot bigger than we anticipated them to be. Yeah. You know, I think we were all designing them at 4 feet, and now we're seeing them at 6-7 feet plus.
Oh.
So that was surprising. So I'm still using Lamandra on every job. Sedicia Skyscraper, mm-hmm. I'm always good to put in there. I like a lot of tall, narrow plants because then you get to fit more in. So Skyscraper's mm-hmm. a nice one to fit in there. And then in terms of the most unusual, I had Brazilia albiflora at my house, which everyone was freaking out about. I lost it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Suspicious skateboard-looking dent in it, in the side of it. So that I'm hoping it was that, not my improper care. And I'm also using a lot of Cassonia. That's my current obsession.
Oh, interesting.
They're a little hard to find. I find them at Point Loma. Mm-hmm. I have not seen them here too often. And you'll see them just really randomly pop up in retail spots. Kind of hard to find. But that's my current obsession. Again, the tall, narrow plant, so you can fit a lot of them in. Mm. So Cassonia paniculata. And then the silver one, the name is escaping me. But there's a few fun varieties that I'm playing with. Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very interesting stuff. We were going to talk about...
I didn't know if John had any follow-ups to his plant questions. Because I think, you know, one of the key things that I thought would be great having him here is to talk about the rainwater capture, being mm-hmm. able to use that water in an efficient manner besides taking a ladle out of a trash can that's next to your garage and walking over and watering plants. Cisterns, you know, if you build that a pump, do you tie that into your irrigation system and those kind of things? And then to think about while you're doing that is the gray water. How effective is that, or how potentially bad is that for some plants? You know, what plants can tolerate it, what can't, and where wouldn't I use it?
Yeah, so gray water is really useful, does really well with a lot of fruit trees. And, you know, it's usually going to be tied into your laundry, your washing machine, which is getting pretty frequently run. I mean, depending, you have to take these things into account. A house with a couple of kids is very different than someone living alone, and there's different uses and frequency of your laundry, but that's the easiest way to do gray water because it just uses the pump on the bottom of your washing machine that pumps that water out into the garden. You do have to use a special detergent. We'll often build in or spec in a valve so you can say, you know, you need to use your load with bleach or something where you want to send that water out to the sewer. So there's a switch we put in the laundry room so you can send some out to the sewer, some out to the garden, or maybe you're just doing a lot of laundry and it's also raining so you don't want to send too much water out to the garden. But fruit trees do really well as long as you use that special detergent. I think the brand is called Eco. And that's pretty straightforward. If your laundry machine is well situated in the house, your laundry room is close to a nice spot in the garden, that's where we look to introduce it. You know, hey, just punch a hole in the wall here, the fruit tree orchards right over there. That works really well. And then in terms of using cistern water, that's where budget really becomes the issue. You know, you can introduce a pump into your system, and all of our Hunter timers or Resheo timers have a switch that says, turn on the pump when you turn on the irrigation, and you can run that from your cistern. You know, it's a pretty significant investment. You need to have someone who knows what they're doing, design it and install it. And then you also need to know that when that cistern runs dry, you either have to have a way to switch back to city water, or there's even systems where there's a float inside the cistern. So when the cistern gets below a certain point, it opens up a valve from your city water, fill it back up so you can just run everything off the cistern. That's kind of the high-end way to do it. You can do it really simply too, where you just have a hose on the bottom of your cistern and can move that around the garden on the weekend when you're working. And there's a kind of in between too, where we call it a branched drain system, where basically you can even have it on a timer that open and closes, but again, we're just using gravity, and you run that cistern water into a series of pipes that go out to different plants via a half inch emitter. And it either opens and closes on a timer or manually, and that just uses gravity to feed the water as well. But these are all really site-dependent, budget-dependent. You know, is the house higher than the garden, lower than the garden? There's a lot of factors you have to take into account.
Where couldn't I use the gray water?
You know, I think most of your, you know, natives, anything that's kind of sensitive or really low water isn't going to want the gray water, mostly due to frequency of watering. But then there's some, you know, plants that you might find, you know, in more saline situations that can kind of handle whatever. There's not too many blanket statements you can make about what works and what doesn't, other than it's really about the frequency that you're watering.
Noted. Okay.
And how about the difference in the gray water? I mean, a lot of people are talking about their washing machine for the gray water. How about shower, bathtubs? You know, I know there's some issues because we wash ourselves in the shower.
We do.
So you have the E. coli that goes out. So how about that in terms of water usage? How would you go about maybe plumbing that and working that into a system?
Yeah. So again, very easy to do if you have a crawl space under your first floor bathroom. Not so easy to do if you're on a slab, unless you're doing this design from a new build. But if you have a crawl space, again, it's an actuator that, I think it's pool equipment is where we get it from, but you can put a button in your bathroom to flip on, and same idea from before. You either direct it out to the sewer or direct it out to the garden. And I think, you know, keeping in mind, because of those things that are going down through the system, you want to be able to clean it out every once in a while. So having some clean outs like you would on any sewer system, doing some regular maintenance, this is where it really takes a special or particular kind of client that's going to stay on top of this. These are not carefree, maintenance-free systems. If you're using gray water, if you're using rainwater, you want to be able to understand how it's working, understand where it's going, understand how to clean it out, diagnose problems, and have someone you can call if there's a problem you're having trouble diagnosing. But again, very site-dependent, but you can pretty much put it anywhere if you're on top of it and you know what you're doing, you know what your plants need, and you see how your soil is responding. You might be using it differently in the winter than during the summer. But again, if you're on a slab, it's going to be really tough to get it into your bathroom. If you're working from the second story or over a crawl space, you got some options. And again, gravity is the biggest factor here. You know, we have so many properties here that are on different types of slopes, or down in the flats near, you know, in certain parts of San Diego or near the coast. So that's really, you got to work for, that's what I look for as a designer, is what makes sense, what's low hanging fruit, so to speak, in terms of what's an easy way to install this without having to rebuild an entire property or spend too much money.
Because of the bacterial issue with shower and bathtub drains, probably stay away from using it in vegetable garden area.
Right. You don't want it on your leafy greens. That's for sure.
Right.
A lot of the times we'll put it into a mulch basin. And that's where as your soil develops and you have that thick layer of mulch and all that microbial bacterial magic that happens in the soil, we'll do a lot to mitigate whatever it is that you're putting into the soil there. You're not going to be spreading it on your leafy greens, but if you're putting it into the ground in a mulch basin for those roots, for whatever plants are nearby to soak it up, you're going to be in pretty good shape.
Yeah, I mean, fruit trees with the fruit, you can probably use it there pretty safely, unless you're splashing it. You know, if it's just being
if it's being processed through the root system of the tree, you're going to be fine. Although, like with laundry, one of the things with that is there's been a lot of talk about phosphates in soap and things like that, and there I believe they've actually been regulating the amount of phosphate that you can that can go into a landscape, which seems kind of counterintuitive given that phosphate is one of the macronutrients that that plants need to survive. So, but you said there's a special special detergent that you can use.
Yeah, I encourage everyone to do their own research on this. I believe the brand's called Eco something, where it's a gray water friendly detergent that's just much lower in salts, basically.
And don't put those phosphates on your Proteaceae plants.
Yeah. None exactly. of those. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Stay away from that.
Well, that's where the rainwater comes in, because they respond nicely to rainwater. It. Yes.
Yeah. That's about all mine gets right now. And it's covered in flowers. Absolutely covered. A pincushion.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and these systems work really well in tandem too, where if you have rainwater diverted into the place where your gray water is going as well, that helps leach out some of that extra stuff that's going to be
there. Oh, that's true. As far as design is concerned, what is trending these days? What are your customers looking for?
Everybody wants low water, low maintenance. I try not to. There's no such thing as a zero maintenance garden. I think the message has thoroughly gotten out that we need climate appropriate planting, and everyone, I think there's still always going to be a learning curve. You start talking about low water garden, there's going to be someone that says, I don't like rocks and cactus. And it's like, well, a low water garden can look at a lot of different ways. That's been really, really popular for a while now, and hopefully it'll stay that way. But yeah, every client, low maintenance, especially if they got kids or, a lot going on in life, that's coming up on every job.
Well, one of the things that we've noticed just industry-wide is when we get into a drought situation, I'll tell you about that when we come back. we need to take a quick break here on Garden Talk, but we'll be back with more, so stay tuned. We'll be back with more Garden Talk right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman, John Clements, and our special guest, Brad Lefkowitz from Waves Landscape Design. And just before the break, before I was rudely interrupted by the commercial, we were talking about what we see in the industry that's based on rainfall. When we have good rainy seasons and the talk of drought dies down, people start to shift over towards wanting more tropical landscape. As we the amount of stuff that we have, the variety of stuff that we can grow in this climate is tremendous. So they want to shift over towards a more tropical look. Then as soon as it starts getting dry again, talk of drought starts coming back. Then it shifts over to low water use plants, native plants and things like that. So we do see that shift from time to time. During the break, we were talking about it and you said you have some of your clients are still interested in taking out lawns and replacing them with typically low water use plants and things like that.
Yeah. So the rebates just got up, I think, from $2 to $3 a square foot. And I think people have been, pretty aware for a long time that in California to have a lawn is a choice. And some people are looking to move away from that. A lot of times it's when the kids have moved out and they're looking to change the landscape. And so, there's still people that want lawns, and I absolutely think there's a place for that. And, with the rebates, a lot of people are looking to take them out and take advantage of that rebate. Sometimes it's taking out the front lawn, keeping it in the back, which makes a lot of sense. It's still all over the place, but there's always been people looking to take out lawns.
And during the break, we were talking about native plants and the rise of native plants. And that's something that I have seen in my 40 years in this business. 40 years ago, there weren't a lot of native plants that were available, but thanks to growers like Native Sons Nursery and Moosa Creek, a local wholesale grower, the variety of natives has grown tremendously over the past decade or two. And there's some, I was never a huge native plant fan, but there's some really, really nice plants on the market now that are natives.
Absolutely. And we're seeing a lot of demand for that. I think people realize there's a lot of benefits to the natives beyond just the low water use and the adaptability to our climate, you know, for local pollinators and stuff. And yeah, the supply, Moosa Creek, Native West, down to Chula Vista, there's a lot of great suppliers. And it's a lot of fun to use. You know, your sages, the fragrance from the sages are always going to be popular. I'm doing a lot of Monardella. Is that the?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm using that a lot. And then even, you know, Dudleas and your Shaw's Agave and stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fun variety, a lot of color, Palmer's Mallow, a lot of fun ones I like to use a lot. I always sneak a few in there.
Shaw's Agave is an amazing agave. I think it should be used so much more in San Diego. And it's a native to San Diego County.
I don't
think
I'm familiar with that.
It's gorgeous. And the inflorescence when it comes out, mm-hmm. it's like a giant orange stalk of asparagus. It's just stunning. The other thing, you know, when it comes to lawns, one can be creative. You mentioned Carex pergracilis earlier. We have plenty of clients where we're putting in quote unquote lawns. It's just mm-hmm. that's a lawn that you're not going to mow. And we make it basically like a low-growing meadow-looking grass. And that can really be a wonderful alternative. And still, you're using as low a water use as you would if this was a native plant garden. And yet, you have something that looks, it's not a manicured, shortcut lawn. On the mm-hmm. other hand, it really is a beautiful green space.
You know, another one for that, which is actually a super economical way to cover large areas of ground, creeping red fescue.
Yeah.
You just put it in the you plant, sow it, and let it go. And mm-hmm. don't ever mow it. And it'll grow up about 10, 12 inches, and mm-hmm. it just lays down.
And it looks
like just a rolling meadow. It's absolutely beautiful when it's grown properly. And the other benefit of creeping red fescue, it'll grow in shade.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of other grasses that you typically see in lawns don't like shade. Mm-hmm. But creeping red fescue does very, very well. Mm-hmm. And easy to grow. Like I said, it's very cost effective to cover large areas. There was a lot on Lake Murray Boulevard.
And on Mira Mesa Boulevard 30, 40 years ago, all the landscapers were putting in creeping red fescue on slopes. And then they would just water it, feed it, and then it would just kind of grow up to a foot or so and then just lean over it. It was very pretty.
Yeah.
So what are some other lawn alternatives that can be used as a lawn, you know, to some degree? Because of the fescue is not a great lawn.
Right.
You know, you're not going to play bocce ball on that.
Crappie, I've done a number of times. You know, the big caveat's there. You need to contain it on all sides. I found the same thing with Carex pergracilis, though. Mm-hmm. It likes to escape as well.
Right.
Crappie is a fun one. You know, the caveat's there, containing it, and then you have the bees that come in the summer months. But you can mow off the flowers, and I've had a lot of families that are enjoying that. Ruchia, I know
John
you've
likes
done
Ruchia.
A lot of,
we have a Ruchia. Big Ruchia plot at our house.
I'm really liking that, particularly as like a little gap filler. And then also it's really fun on bare feet too.
Mm-hmm.
I have some over, I have my trash cans are on DG. And so if I walk out there barefoot, you know, you get a little bit of that DG on your bare feet, and I have a little patch of Ruchia right next to it that I use to as my little mat to wipe my feet off. That's a lot of fun. And then the Carex ones are I'm doing some of those as well.
What was popular a few years ago, and I think it's kind of waned in popularity a little bit, but pretty easy to maintain and low water use and stays flat, was Diamondia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that will take some foot traffic. And that's one of the things that we've seen when you get away from the grass type lawns. It's tough to beat some of the grasses as far as foot traffic is concerned.
Right.
You know, there's other things that you can put out for ground cover. I know some of the thymes and things like that, but they don't
respond well to your kid
they don't
and
like,
dog.
Yeah, they don't they don't like being walked on.
Right.
One of the ground covers we used to have all over the front out here, and we sold tons of it when we had it in was Moneywort. Mm-hmm. Which I think is it's an outstanding ground cover.
Flash from the past.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about the closest thing to dichondra that you can find. But it's a really neat trailing plant, little yellow flower on it in the spring and summer. And it will take a little bit of foot traffic. You're not going to be running around on it, but, you can walk across it, lightly.
One of the challenges I run into with some of these lawn alternatives is you talk about crappie and ruchia, even Carex, you need to plant it as plugs. Mm-hmm. So you need to prepare the client to have a little bit of patience for that to fill in. If someone out there wants to start growing Carex pregrosilis as sod, I will sell a lot of it for you. So if anyone could figure that out, that'd be great.
Yeah. I think my favorite lawn alternative that I ever found was dichondra. I just absolutely love dichondra, and nobody's growing it anymore.
No.
You can still get seed, but all of the sod suppliers that we have that we used to get it from are gone.
And back in the day, so I'm old enough to remember this, that if one had a dichondra lawn, also in the garage would be a can of Dowpon. Do you remember this? Talk about the horrible chemicals we used to put on our landscapes. Dowpon is a herbicide, and you could put it on the dichondra and kill the weedy grasses and things.
Yeah.
Isn't there a type of insect, though, that gets on that?
Flea beetle.
Flea beetle. That's what I was thinking of. The flea beetles, yes. We'll just decimate that.
But my dad used to tell a story that when dichondra was really popular, and his uncle had a sod farm up in Rancho Santa Fe, and that was one of their crops was dichondra. But we had a Japanese gardener who was a customer of ours a long, long time ago. And the only thing he did was maintain dichondra lawns. And the only thing he used was Scott's Super Bonus, which was made specifically for dichondra. And the herbicide that was in it was Monuron, is no longer available on the open market. But that he would just come in and buy Scott's Super Bonus. Mm. And that's what he would go out and feed all of his customers' lawns with it. And then they took Monuron off the market, and that was really the beginning of the decline of dichondra on a regular basis. There just aren't good chemical controls that you can use to keep some of the pest plants out of it. But man, if you know what you're doing and you can grow it, it is absolutely amazing. I remember going to my dad's uncle's place to pick up dichondra, because we used to stock it at the nursery in two square foot pieces, standing in the middle of 2 or 3 acres of dichondra without a weed in sight or a bare spot. And it was
better living through chemicals. It is,
and you're it still is, here to tell us about it.
It is just amazing. And there was a time when my dad's uncle would supply the dichondra for the fair. And I don't know if you remember in the flower show, that was the finishing touch on all the exhibits, was anything that was left over that was dirt, it got covered in dichondra. Mm. And they sold thousands of square feet of dichondra to the fairgrounds every year for the exhibits in the flower show.
Where do you see trends going, you think, Brad, in terms of design? Or are you getting this feedback from clients? Like, are there any shifts you see in the market?
I'm not, it's hard working, one-on-one with clients. I have a couple clients a month. I don't get a real large sample size. And I think now people are kind of finding me now that my portfolio has grown. I think people are finding me to do what I do for them. Water capture is getting a little easier to sell, particularly when we talk about topography and, creating a cool feature. I'm a firm believer every garden needs a bridge. So when you put a nice little swale into a garden, create that topography, it gives you the option to do a bridge, whether it's a boulder bridge is really fun for the kids, or a wood bridge. So it's starting to make sense. Mm. And when you tell people it's going to rain here, let's put it in the ground, not just send it off to the storm drain, especially when I'm working near the coast, everyone surfs. They don't want that stormwater carrying all that pollution out to the ocean. So that's getting easier to sell. Native plants we talked about. It's people always surprise you with their requests, and you kind of got to meet them where they are for the most part.
So, and are you pretty much using Brooke Sarson for doing the, I think she's the only game in town.
Brooke in Catching H2O. She taught me everything I know in terms of water capture. She's really great at the installing.
We're going to have Brooke as well down the road. On here too.
She's the
touch
best.
Space.
Mm-hmm. And she's trained a lot of people now. So the biggest challenge for a while was finding an installer that actually believes that it'll work, and knows how to install it. And so that's getting easier. That's been a big challenge. I've had a lot of builders over the years do some very strange things, whether it's putting, a drainage pipe underneath a whole creek bed to defeat the purpose of it. You got to keep an eye on these things. But I've got a good slew of builders I work with now that know what they're doing.
Brad, thank you very much for coming in. It's been very interesting talking to you. Brad Lefkowitz from Waves Landscape Design. He's going to be teaching a class for us on May 17th, so make a note of that. And the garden class today in Poway is going to be Staghorn Ferns with James Flynn. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We'll be back next week with another hour. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.